All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the HTA2 Proposed Rule Task Force meeting for Group 2. I'm Seth Pazinski. I'm with the HHS Assistant Secretary for Technology Policy, and I'll be serving as your designated federal officer for today. And as a reminder, this meeting is open to the public, and public feedback is encouraged throughout the meeting. Comments can be made via the Zoom chat feature. There is also time scheduled at the end of our agenda for verbal public comments. So we are gonna go ahead and get started with our meeting, and we're gonna start with a roll call. And I'll start with our chair, Mark Sendak.
Present.
Suresh Ballou. Hans Bootendijk.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Steve Eichner.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Raj Gudvarti.
Present.
And I did get a message that Mary Beth Carrillo will not be able to make our call today. Next is Hung Lu.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Meg Marshall. Alex Muggy. Shantanu Nundy. Dan Riskin.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon. Phil Sutherland. Naresh Sundar Rajan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Cheryl Turney.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. All right, thank you. Is there anyone I missed or who just joined us? Okay, and then I will turn it over to our chair, Mark Sendak, to get us into our meeting.
Thank you. So we have a lot of topics to cover today. I was really excited last week to see us starting to get into the spreadsheet. We're going to continue that kind of format today, where we'll have a brief presentation from our ASTP colleagues, and then we'll spend, it'll look like 50 minutes going through the worksheet. As always, please feel free to drop comments and work on that between these meetings. And otherwise, looking forward to jumping in today. So we can go to the next slide to review the agenda. So we're going to have 10 minutes with our ASTP colleagues, 10 minutes for discussion, which if we have more to discuss, we can go over or less under. Spend most of the time today in the worksheet, have 5 minutes at the end for public comment, and then we'll cover next steps. Next slide. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, the charge for our task force, we are the HTI2 Proposed Rule Task Force, where we are evaluating and providing draft recommendations to HITECH on the HTI2 Proposed Rule. We are reviewing and providing recommendations on proposals that are specific to standards and certification, so we're the subgroup. And then our timeline is that the recommendations are due prior to the end of the 60-day public comment period. Our presentation to HITECH, I think, is September 12th. So we have another few weeks to finish going through the content. Next slide, please. So today we have 5 topics that we're going to go through. As I mentioned, we're going to spend most of the time in the worksheet, where we'll build out each of these bullets, spend some time going through each bullet. We are going to be using a new feature today that's going to be a timer to help us continue to move forward and touch on everything that we need to. And otherwise, it's going to feel similar to the last few meetings. So I think that's going to be it for my part. And on the next slide, I'll hand over to our ASTP colleagues to start the presentation.
All right. Thanks, Mark. this is Jeff Smith again, your friendly ASTP workgroup ticket taker. Rob Anthony is otherwise disposed at the moment, so I'm going to be stepping in for him to cover a couple of slides that really do cover, I would say, almost a potpourri of certification updates, but actually several of those certification criteria are related to our privacy and security framework and speak to some advancements that we're proposing in the privacy and security space, primarily, I would say, in the security space, but not exclusively, and generally trying to, we're proposing to improve the posture of our privacy and security framework, and we are proposing to make inroads to making access to not just imaging reports, but imaging actual images themselves more routine and easier. And then we are also looking to, we're proposing to rather update our clinical information reconciliation and incorporation certification criterion. So let's jump right into it, please. Next slide. Oh, yes, the disclaimer. So everything that you really need to know is in HTI2, which is published last Monday through the Federal Register. That is going to be the source of truth. What we are doing here is trying to present a consolidated, abbreviated, and otherwise high-level overview of our proposals. And then obviously the preamble is and associated reg text for HTI2 is where you would have wanted to spend most of your time contemplating proposals. Next slide, please. Okay, so on the new imaging requirements for health IT modules, we propose to revise a handful of certification criteria, including the transitions of care, view, download, transmit, and a couple of standardized API criteria to include support for access, exchange, and use of diagnostic imaging images via imaging links. ASCP is not proposing a specific standard associated with the support of this functionality, and we note that this requirement can be met with a context-sensitive link to an external application which provides access to images and their associated narratives. Excuse me. We propose that by January 1st, health IT developers with modules certified to any of those certification criteria, that is B1, E1, G9, or G10, must update their health IT module and provide the updated versions to their customers to maintain certification and support access to those links. The benefits, I think, are inherently understandable, but we spell out that diagnostic images are often stored in systems external to EHRs, such as picture archiving and communication systems, or PACS, and vendor-neutral archives, or VNAs. We believe that promoting access to and the exchange of images via these requirements would encourage more widespread adoption and integration of these already existing pathways and reduce burdens caused by physical media exchange. And we do opine further in the proposed rule on benefits and duplication and reduction of waste as all being additional benefits for this potential certification criteria update. Next slide, please. All right, on the clinical information reconciliation and incorporation, which we call CIRI for shorthand, we propose two options actually for revising the CIRI certification criterion. One is to both would expand the number and types of data elements that health IT modules certified to this criterion would be required to reconcile and incorporate. Today, there are only three data types: meds, problems, allergies, that need to be reconciled, and we are, through our primary proposal, requiring that all US CDI data elements be essentially reconcilable and incorporatable, if you want to think about it like that. We are proposing that really every single US CDI data element, and that would be version 4 consistent with this proposal, would be available for clinical information reconciliation and incorporation. Now, we do have an alternative proposal, which would be a good place for this group to focus its energies on the pros and cons of each. And this would require a series of a more limited set of additional US CDI data elements. So more than three, but less than the total suite of US CDI data elements. We also propose to add a new functional requirement to enable user configuration and rules-based automatic clinical information reconciliation and incorporation. We think that the benefits to this would be support for longitudinal patient records and longitudinal patient care, It would better enable patients' story to be consolidated and understood in a more concise fashion. And also there's numerous patient safety benefits that would come from this, we believe. And we think that this would also have a net benefit for providers by reducing the burden of reconciliation incorporation by having more, setting a baseline expectation that more data elements would be reconcilable and incorporatable, not just the three that are currently the baseline today. All right, next slide, please. Okay, so the next, I think, three slides are going to be more, are all focused on our security, privacy and security framework certification criteria. Those are, generally speaking, found in 170.315D. This first one is multi-factor authentication, and we propose to revise the existing multi-factor MFA certification criterion at D13, and accordingly update the affected criteria and privacy security certification framework in 170.550H. This proposal would revise the MFA criterion by replacing what is currently a yes-no attestation requirement with a specific requirement to support multi-factor authentication and configuration for three certification criteria. That is the patient portal view download transmit E1 criterion, the standardized API for patient population level services at G10 for patient facing access, and electronic prescribing at B3. I'll note here that these proposals oftentimes get confused when understood by the general public. These would be would require that computers support multi-factor authentication, not require that users actually implement the multi-factor authentication. So this is a capability of the technology, not a requirement for the users, something that the users can avail themselves of, not something that they necessarily need to take advantage of. We believe the benefits of these would essentially help improve consistency between certification program requirements and industry best practice, particularly for important authentication use cases, such as patients accessing their health information, prescribers using electronic prescription, as well as patients viewing, downloading, and transmitting information from one place to another. So next slide, please. Okay, so ASCP also proposes to revise D7 to include a new requirement that health IT modules certified to this existing criterion encrypt personally identifiable information stored on end user devices and server side. Additionally, we propose to adopt the latest NIST FIPS NXA approved algorithms for encryption, and we reference that standard in the certification criterion, and we would propose moving it from the 2014 version of the standard to the 2021 version of the standard. Essentially, encryption of server-side data prevents unauthorized data access in many scenarios, including those involving a server breach, theft, or improper disposal. Improved security by updating these requirements would align to the latest NIST-approved encryption algorithms. So server-side would be the additional enhancement or revision that we're requiring or that we're proposing for this D7 criterion. Next slide, please. Okay, so on this one, we are proposing to revise the encrypt authentication credentials certification criterion that is currently at D12. Similar to multi-factor authentication today, the certification program requires modules to attest yes or no to being able to encrypt authentication credentials. And we are proposing that modules have this capability. No longer making it kind of optional. We also propose to have these modules support the NIST FIPS 140-2 standard from 2021. We also propose to change the name of this criterion to Protect Stored Authentication Credentials, which would more appropriately describe the revised criterion. Again, we think this promotes protection of stored authentication credentials according to NIST standards, and that this is a important defensive step to help ensure that stolen or leaked authentication credentials are useless to an attacker. So with that, I think those are the criteria for today's session. You can go to the next slide, please. Okay. There you have it.
Thank you, Jeff. So we have 10 minutes allocated for discussion. Once again, just to remind folks, similar message as our last meeting is that if there's questions around just kind of general education and background required for this, we may want to try to answer those amongst the task force members rather than directing those directly to ONC. But if there's anything to kind of clarify from the ONC presentation, we can take those questions now. So I don't see any hands up, but I want to give folks an opportunity. Does anyone have any questions on the presentation? Okay. So if there's no questions now, what we will do is move to the worksheet.
Okay, I'll pull up. Give me one second.
And this, let me confirm. I think it should be in the Google, it should be in the invite. So folks can go to the invite and then click the link to the Google Doc. So you have that yourselves.
And can you see my screen and does it look okay?
Yes. And Sarah, can you just orient us quickly? Are you at the top now, are you at the row that starts for today?
Yes, row 33, the new imaging requirements. And we will have, I believe, 15 minutes for that discussion.
And how many rows in total do we have today?
Five or six.
Okay. Five. Cool. Oops. And then I know that okay, there's the timer. I was just going to ask about that. So that's what we see now in the top right. Cool. Okay, so this first, I can just give folks a minute to read this. And then Hans, it looks like you already put a comment. So maybe after a minute, then we'll go to you, Hans, to kind of share any feedback.
Sounds good.
Okay. So Hans, do you want to kind of provide more background or context on your comment here? Hans, you're muted.
Sorry, I thought that I hit the button. Sorry about that. So, well, this is a challenging criterion because on the one hand, there is clear interest and need to make progress in this space and get access to the image as well. Current reality is that this remains hard. And it's hard not to that technically you could have a link, you could share it and otherwise, but the systems, other than very few, who would have the imaging capabilities as part of their solutions, is that you have to deal with third-party image providers, PACs, otherwise, that may or may not be located in the organization. And where it's within the organization, there is a lot that within the provider ecosystem, those links are very focused, tailored, and may contain information that are okay to share inside, but are not necessarily great to share with a patient externally that then needs to convey that to the other party. And the standards to be able to do that on the imaging side would have to be adopted as well to make that work so that we're not going to require everybody to create all kinds of individual bespoke scenarios. So that's the challenge that the management of the link it would be the hard part to ensure that it's secure, safe, and consistently applied to any of the reasonable image providers that are out there. So that makes it hard to say, is that, are we ready? We want to be ready, but are we ready?
Mm-hmm. And so are there kind of security, are there things that we can incorporate into a recommendation to address some of the security vulnerabilities?
I think we could address that, and indicators that addressing those concerns are critical to making this practical and viable. And the two part of it is that we not only look at certified software. This is very much a great example of it needs to work on both sides. So what will be in place on the other side where the image is residing, that these capabilities are in place at that same point in time as well, in a wide adoption, or sufficiently adopted that and available that that can work. Otherwise, we are going to create effectively a one side, and either you have to bespoke it to either to the variety of image providers out there, or it's not going to be as deployable because it's not there. So we have created capabilities not quite there. So there is a fair amount of work that has been going on. Argonaut, HL7 Argonaut has been working on it as well in the last year, for example. So there are some very promising and progress being made, but it's the practical implementation and the vulnerabilities that that are still raising concerns whether this is truly ready.
And just to clarify, and then I'll go to you, Rajesh. It sounds like part of the concern is making sure that the imaging link is functioning as it's intended. Is there...
And secure.
Yes. So one is secure. The other is whether it actually will work. Are there kind of tests that we can reference or conformance with some procedure that would be helpful to put in a recommendation?
I'm not sure yet whether that's there. Would have to check with some of the people that have been working in that space more in detail whether the actual tests are there. DICOM has been working a lot in this space as well. So Argonaut has been working with a number of people that also are active in DICOM. So we would have to look there and see whether that we can point to actual tests or need to indicate that appropriate tests need to be provided. But it needs to apply to both sides of the fence, and that's the critical part.
Yeah. Rajesh.
Yeah, maybe there are other federal standards, Hans, on the imaging security. I don't know, NIST and maybe others have something along those lines. But that's one thought. My couple of observations on this one is when we use the word transmit, probably we are referring to transmitting over the wire, not necessarily transmitting things in real time, because these images are given based on the request, not necessarily shared synchronously, right, as they're coming in. So that is probably one clarification. The second is, you said the certification requirement says application access all data request. That's a very broad term. Maybe it's good to qualify what is all data means in this context.
So I'm writing your note, like I'm trying to synthesize this in column I. So the first part of your comment is wanting to clarify the circumstances of the image link transition. Mm-hmm. And then the second part was, where does it say all data?
In column E, the E1, 315
E1. Okay. You're saying for, is that the, okay, application access all data request for G, E1. You're saying, is it really all data or is there?
Yeah. What does it really mean?
And just to make sure I'm reading this right, is that referencing E1 or G9?
E1. That's what I thought. D1? No, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's G9. You're right.
Commas are confusing me.
Yes. Oh, it's G9, yeah.
Okay. Any other comments on this row? So we're looking at row 33, E, column E.
This is still, I guess another issue is looking at patient access to data. And that may make the security aspects a bit more complicated, not because patients are less secure than providers, but it's a much broader audience or a much broader set of consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Hans, do you have any thoughts on that space?
Yeah, it depends on the, it goes back in part as the patients that are operating outside the portal would have additional considerations that they're not operating necessarily at that point in time inside the provider's ecosystem, infrastructure, firewall, etc. So I think there are increased considerations to make sure that that remains secure for that patient. So I think it depends a little bit on in what context is the link being made available through an API that's then shared beyond, or if through a portal that it's clicked on right there, which are different.
But yeah, absolutely. But other requirements in HTI2, I think, imply that the data needs to be available to patients via an API and not just via a portal.
Correct. And in that context is that I think that the comments that I made about some of the vulnerability challenges that then exist on how that URL is typically constructed currently, where you can do it inside the ecosystem, now needs to be robust enough so that it doesn't cause any challenges when it's used from outside. And that would be different than from a provider perspective that is operating within their infrastructure.
Okay, so I'm incorporating that into the discussion comments. So it sounds like specifically if the link is shared directly to the patient through an API and not through, and just to make sure I understand this correctly, because we have the other row to discuss around MFA, are we imagining that this link is made available in a way that the multi-factor authentication would not cover, or some type of authentication would not cover?
I think those would be two separate issues, because it's more the content of the link than whether you, with multi-factor authentication, get or do not get the link because you were not properly authenticated as the patient or whomever.
Or be able to follow, like, more specifically.
Yeah. So I think that's two separate issues.
So you're saying the link itself could maybe not direct to the image, but could direct to some other malicious.
No, it could direct to the right one, but the right one may, the format and the content may vary from one to the next vendor. So it would have to accommodate variations unless they have adopted the same standard on how to construct that. Are we there yet? That's the question mark concern. And the other part is that the information as it's put in there, how is it being constructed otherwise, so to ensure that it doesn't divulge any logon or other information, et cetera.
Right,
so,
in part, what does the link get me? I mean, does it get me the actual image? Does it get me a landing page with the image?
It's meant to get to the actual image that then can be viewed or downloaded if you so desire. So that still open, but you get to the actual image in that context from that. That's the way we interpreted it. It's not to a opening page.
But I guess there, even at that point, I would still think about looking at resolution, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, at least my initial thought would be on the requester end to say, hey, do I want a low res image to start with, or do I want a high res image to start with, so I'm not wasting a bunch of bandwidth on something that's not useful to me.
So one quick question that may help with this. It sounds like, Hans, you were saying that Argonaut is currently working on this. I don't know if it's going to be them or something else, but in column I, should we try to reference a standard or effort to develop a standard that we would recommend aligning this with?
Yeah, Argonaut has been working on it. They completed an effort, I think about, I'm not going to have the exact time, I'm going to say 6 months ago or something like that. I need to look it up exactly when they wrapped up their last effort. And there is more that has come from that. So we could point to them, indicating that building on things like that, we could make some comments there. The question then is still the adoption across the board. Is it firm enough at this point in time? And that's the part that I'm not convinced that it's firm enough yet to point to a published document that's adopted. And then is everybody adopting it? And do we can we overcome some of the challenges with the URL that are being raised and that we need to learn a little bit more about over the next couple of weeks?
I guess just as an aside, thinking about resolution up front, I can see big issues with not having some guidance about that or some decisions made based on what platform and what connectivity I have, especially from a patient perspective or someone who's not thinking about what their connectivity looks like. Yeah, I'm walking around with my cell phone, you know, on broadband connectivity, downloading a super high res image, and I've just consumed a bunch of unnecessary capacity, spending money, whatever, versus phone in a Wi-Fi environment versus something that has a monitor or display that's can actually display the image at the quality I'm retrieving. And on down the line.
From our perspective, that would be primarily looking at the image platform that would manage that, whereas the, if you will, the EHR would have the link and share it appropriately, get the link and share it appropriately in the right places, etc. But that would then be not part of the certified software if it says EHR to have those capabilities. It will be the viewer, wherever the viewer lives.
But the EHR software, from my perspective, should have as a certification criteria support for request based on resolution. So the EHR is serving the right resolution for the consumer.
Well, we would not serve necessarily that image. It would be served by the image server. And we don't know whether the patient is going to do that now or is going to do it next month with an iPad instead of an iPhone or an Android or whatever. So I don't think that can be a expectation of an EHR to manage. It's the viewer that is being invoked, whoever has that.
So I think we'll probably want to move on. I did try to capture your concern about kind of the format and resolution of the image in the third section of what I put in column I. So we can feel free to continue iterating on that. But yeah, let's go to row 34. So once again, I'll give folks maybe 30 seconds just to orient yourself, and then can we start the timer for this row? Perfect. Cool.
Can you zoom in a little bit, please?
That better?
A bit.
So this is the row that during Jeff's presentation, he was describing how there's kind of two potential recommendations to consider. One that looks at recommending all data elements, and then another, which it looks like is six additional USCDI data classes beyond the existing three. So Hans, it looks like you put in something for row G. So do you want to give us some context for your comment there?
Sure. And this comment is on a particular aspect of the last bullet in the proposal. But I can also comment on the suggestion on everything or some data or data elements from USCDI. The comment that I wrote here is that there is one of the proposals is that that certified software support user configurable and automated reconciliation. Those kind of capabilities beyond staying able to reconcile get into aspects of the systems themselves beyond interoperability. And the question is that do we need to focus on that as part of certification criteria, or let that be flexible? So you have to be able to reconcile, and then we can talk about how much, but you can reconcile. And then it depends on the context, the setting, the size, the volume, other elements to determine is automated reconciliation necessary to be able to support that. Perhaps for larger institutions it is, for smaller it isn't, so depending on the specialty EHR, et cetera. So is that really necessary for ONC criteria to be that level of details to specify how best to do that? So that's where the first part comes up. A suggestion is that the criteria should not have to specify exactly the different means by which it can be done. Not to say that you could not do it, but not that it requires you to do the variety of things there. As long as you can reconcile, and then you can figure out what's best for your setting. Go ahead.
Hans, this is just, it's not directly in the line of work that I do. So can you give us an example of automatic reconciliation for one of the three currently? Because in my mind, is this like normalizing units of weight? Like what does this actually look like in practice?
What it could mean is that, let's say conditions, diagnoses are one, problems, medications, let's pick on medications because that has units and other things. It is that from different sources or as you get over time, you get new medication prescription information in. How can I recognize that I actually already have the information about that prescription available? So I have from different sources, I have the same prescription effectively coming back to me. How can I identify those and then dedupe them, reconcile them to say, hey, I already got it. There is no need to reconcile. Or, no, this is new, never seen before. Do you want to get it into your record as a reconciliation? And say, yes, I need to know about that. Or, no, I don't. So there are abilities that can be used to how to make more of that based on a variety of rules and otherwise. Depending on your volume that you have, that may be very helpful. In terms of data received from other external systems, or it may not be as critical, or different users obviously may have different levels of criteria to do that. So there's tremendous opportunity, but there's also, does everybody need to do that? So that's where the question is coming from. Is that a required capability, or is it just you have to be able to reconcile, and then you may opt to provide automated capabilities for that or not. The other proposal is that everybody must support to be certified. You must be able to have an automated version.
And just to make sure we understand the implications, is it that if there's not automated reconciliation, for example, if I'm the patient looking in my patient portal, that I may have a bunch of duplicate instances of data that were not reconciled, it just kind of like shapes the quality of the data that's visible to clinicians and patients? Is that the
So today it is the provider that reconciles, that gets somebody qualified in the organization that reconciles, that's presented with new data, and then is presented to indicate, oh, from this new source, I have this data. I currently have this data, this other data already available. It overlaps, it's the same, it's new, and then makes decisions whether to include that into the EHR. So if it's done all right, then the patient, when they ultimately look at their portal or otherwise, the data has been reconciled when they look at this. That's from that perspective. So it all depends on how good and how fast you do the reconciliation, that you see less duplicative data there, or that you see only important data that is relevant for that in that context. So that's what reconciliation aims to do. So that there is A, awareness that as data comes in, hey, there are new things you should consider. And B is that things that you already have that you can say, yeah, already got it. And you can do that manually, or you can do it automatically to some extent. Question is the key that you can reconcile? And then depending, and let the vendors and the providers determine when it's helpful to have or not have automation of that to a greater or lesser extent.
And Hans, I also think a lot about data quality. The ability to reconcile doesn't necessarily mean, how do you know that that means you're reconciling correctly? And is there a log of how the data was reconciled if you want to trace back to see if there was potentially some alteration made to the data that wasn't correct?
Typically is that you have a log and you have ability to trace back as to what you pulled in, what you and that you move forward. It's not necessary that the data changes. It is that you include it or exclude it from the record.
Got it.
That's Cheryl. What reconciliation typically means.
Yeah, and I want to pile on to what Hans is saying, because you know, having looked at this in the past and currently, there isn't always good updates when you're getting corrected information. So there may be an ability in the system to do a reconciliation, but you know, to take it from the patient portal, as you were saying, Mark, it may be that the patient's already updated, those medications are not current and there's new ones, or there's different ones, but then you go into the doctor's office and they're asking you all the same question. So that may have been updated at some point in like my chart, but it doesn't somehow get to the doctor's office. So when and if they're using those reconciliations, I think is part of the question. And just having the ability to have reconciliations doesn't fix the problem. But along with that, we don't have a standard process still, and I think it should be noted, for patient corrections, because even with a reconciliation process, when the patient says, oh, this, and it happened to someone in my family where they were diagnosed for cancer for something, that is still on their record, but that what tumor wasn't cancerous. So I don't know what the procedure needs to be, but there's no standard for how to fix that data. So I think we need to at least comment on that.
So we want to take a step back, and I know we have 5 minutes left for this. What I'm hearing is, I think there's a lot of alignment that we want like high quality, accurate data, and that there is a need to reconcile, whether that's done manually or automatically. I think the concerns I'm hearing is this going to actually solve the problem, or is it going to not solve the problem and introduce complexity? So I guess is there anyone here who has a strong sense that automatic reconciliation does solve an important problem for the users of the health certified health IT systems? Cheryl? Yeah.
I believe automatic reconciliation will be more problematic because someone has to evaluate what's been reconciled. And if no one is evaluating it, then you don't know, you may get more incorrect information. So I really feel when you're getting data from multiple sources and multiple doctors, that can't really be automated, in my opinion, or have it be done in the background. It needs some interaction with a human.
Yeah, and maybe to provide the other perspective on that is that we do believe that there can be tremendous value from an efficiency and still maintain good accuracy perspective. The question is that is it always necessary for all EHR to be certified against, which is a different question of is there value and does it have capabilities? It definitely does. There are clearly scenarios where we can see that when you take that kind of an approach, you can actually eliminate comfortably and with a high level of confidence, you can remove a series of data coming in that you comfortably know, I already have it. It's not new data. You don't have to look at it so that you can look at data that is actually new, different from what you have. Depending on volumes that you deal with, that helps substantially, or you don't need to because the volume is not that high, or the context is such that you may not need to do it. So that's where more the question comes from. Is it something that is needed to be required versus does it have value to do?
And so thinking about the recommendation we want to put forward, it seems like right now it's required for 3 data elements. There's 2 options, to go to 6 or to go to all. But are we also thinking that there should be an option to go to none and even remove the requirement for the 3 that currently are?
There are 2 different questions. Is that reconciliation in itself is good? We're not arguing that it should disappear, to be very clear. No, it's just the method by which you reconcile should you put particular requirements on that. That's a different parallel but independent question. So when it's looking at should we allow for or require more data elements to be reconciled and start to increase the bar, I think the answer is somewhere between everything versus adding some. Not going down to 0, not at all. Expand the list, most certainly. But does it make sense to, in one jump, expand to everything? Or does it make sense to, let's say, look at specifically problems, allergies, intolerance, medication we already have, and immunization, but start to expand to procedures, laboratory, clinical notes, data elements around that to say is that, okay, that's a good next step. Or do we say is that, no, that you go to everything, that's just a substantial amount of work for to get that done with everything else. So individually, you might say, great, but in light of all other criteria there and the time window, you would start to say, let's prioritize and focus on a number, a smaller number than everything.
Got it. So it sounds like we're leaning towards 6. Don't go to all, go to 6. And then Cheryl, I see your comment, but if you want to.
Yeah, so I would just add, I don't disagree with Hans, but what I think we need to recommend first is that standards be developed for reconciliation and then applied as we're suggesting. But right now there's no standards for reconciliation, and that's part of the problem. So if we, and normally these stand, the certification implements a standard that already exists, and there isn't one for this. So I think we need to say we need to develop the standard, and then it needs to be applied to XYZ.
I was just going to ask, does this look good?
And so it's Cheryl, just to make sure, it is standards on how to enable automatic reconciliation versus the number of ones that can already start, whether they're automated or not.
Yes, because I don't disagree with you, Hans. I mean, when we did large language models, we used automation, but we spit out anything that appeared to be different. And there was a standard applied to it. So I'm just saying we need that same kind of standard applied to this and it needs to be agreed upon on everyone, because payer or provider system A does it one way, provider system B does it another way, then the standards are not even consistent that we're using. So like let's follow our own process, develop the standard for it to automate it, and then apply it to what you're.
Okay, perfect. So I think we're at time. And it seems like those two things were, we have consensus on. So we'll go to row 35. I think we're plenty zoomed in. I'll give folks 30 seconds if we can start the timer again, and then we'll open up to discussion for this one. Okay, so this one is about MFA and changing the criteria from kind of yes or no to a requirement to support MFA. So there's nothing in G, but I'll give folks an opportunity. Does anyone have any specific changes they would like to propose for this?
Not yet. We might get a few more, but the next couple, some discussions still need to occur to make sure I can represent a more general perspective.
Okay. So if there's nothing, I don't feel like what I'm hearing, Hans, is not to necessarily go ahead and in column J say we recommend like the language as it is stated, right? It's that this is something we may need to come back to.
It's the latter. Don't see right now many challenges, but just want to confirm with a group that's talking about it shortly.
Okay.
Nothing jumps out at the moment.
Anything else for this row? I'll just put TBD for column J. If we don't have anything here, I'm open to go back up to row 34. Hans, I see your comment. Do you want to kind of speak your perspective on the concept that I think Cheryl put forward of, do we first want to recommend developing standards for how to conduct automatic reconciliation?
My comment is around, is it standards? Is it guidance? Depends on what you're looking at to try to reconcile. What you're trying to get out, and reconciliation, at least, and it might need to be some terminology. Reconciliation is not as much about extracting and ingesting the data to take out of a document and now put it into discrete format. That's part of it, obviously. But is it what you take out, particularly from the structured component? Do you already have it as is? So depending on what your starting source is. That may be narrative otherwise, but I'm not yet sure whether it means that there are standards or whether if we really need to first discuss the concept of guidance or what makes something that can work, because it's a hard space to say is there a single set of rules that you can apply before you can say everybody can do it the same, or is there still a fair amount of learning to be done to figure out what are some of the kind of rules there are. How do I use provenance data? How do I use actual data itself in the absence of provenance, et cetera? So there are certain things, and therefore, at what thresholds are you going to start to say, I'm going to toss it to a user as opposed to the user is comfortable that I have a good confidence level that I can pass it. Are we trying to define confidence levels? So I think that that in itself requires a discussion as to what is it exactly that you're looking for.
So, and just to make sure I'm using the right terminology, because I know that there's implementation guides. Is it developing implementation guidance or implementation guides?
It possibly might translate, if I hear Cheryl correctly, but she can speak better to that, that it has the kind of a format of an implementation guide, a reconciliation implementation guide. But is that expressive of certain very specific standards? Or is it at the level of, if you will, I'm just drawing a picture there of best practices, which is different. So I think there might still be a discussion. What would that look like? But having the conversation would be interesting to do.
Yeah, Cheryl?
Yeah, I agree with Hans. I mean, we don't have implementation guides for things that aren't like a transport or something like that. But there are best practices, and maybe that is the right term, is to develop best practices for reconciliation. And there are some areas that have done some white papers on this process. I know I've seen a couple of them. I see if I can find one that I can share a link to. But there are some recommended methods to be used. And I think that that would provide greater comfort level, that because at the end of the day, we don't want duplicate information that's going to add a lot of burden, but we also want to make sure that the information that's reconciled is accurate to the extent that we can validate it to be so. So to me, those are the two goals. And if there is a way to achieve that goal, then I think that a best practice could be referenced in terms of this particular certification requirement.
Okay, perfect. So I change the language in I to say recommend developing best practices or implementation guides.
Putting one reference in the chat right now.
Here, I can put that link in the Google. Are folks okay with that to move forward? Okay, we will move on to, I think we're at 36 now. So let's start the timer again, and then we'll spend 30 seconds looking through this one. So this criteria is about encryption of the data in the health IT systems. There's no comments right now in column G. Does anyone want to take the opportunity to, yeah, go ahead, Rajesh.
As I read the language, instead of using the word server, oh, sorry, I'm in 36. One second. Server side, right? Encrypt the EHI stored server side. I think the word server side is, you know, could lead to a misunderstanding in my view, because typically the storage systems are now with the cloud enabled, not anymore like client and server. I think if we can leave the language, all the EHI storage systems, that would be better than a server client language that we used to deal with.
So you're saying instead of using server side, replace with just health IT storage?
Yeah.
Okay. I can move that over to the work group recommendation. Any other comments for row 36? And Hans, is this one too where you said the next few on the prior row, is this one too where you expect to?
Correct. Yep. So as soon as I have that, I'll drop in some thoughts. Yep.
Perfect. Okay. Anything else for 36? Cheryl?
Oh, sorry, I think I was on mute. I have a question. So when you're reading this part of it, I was assuming this was meaning anything that was PII or PHI, but are they really saying that all health IT information, including the whole medical record, really needs to be encrypted? Or just that information that would make it attributable to a person or an organization?
So I guess one question there is the term EHI, is that electronic health information? Do we know what that is?
Yes, that's what that is.
And so is this a question that ONC folks can clarify?
Yeah, sorry. Can you repeat the question, Cheryl?
Cheryl, we don't hear you. I don't know if you're muted.
Okay, so is the intent of the encryption to be the any identifiable components of the EHI record, which are, you know, obviously PHI or PII, or is it the entire medical record that has to be encrypted?
So this is, sorry, Sarah, can you go to the left there just so I make sure I'm on the right criterion? Yeah, so essentially what we're proposing is to apply the exact same requirements that we have for end user devices onto servers. So today, there are no requirements for encryption of EHI when it's stored on a server. And we do have requirements for EHI to be encrypted when it's stored on a device, and what we're looking to do is just apply pretty much the exact same requirements so that both the server side and the end device side are both encrypted in the same way using the same standards. To your exact question in terms of like the entire record, I mean it would be any EHI that is in the system. And I know that we talked about, I think I've got my colleagues, Keith on the phone, on the line, who might be able to shed additional details on, is this the criterion that we also included or referenced PII?
A link to the preamble with some more information on like the PII definition.
Yeah, but you know, essentially what we're looking to do is shore up the transaction. So essentially the exact same requirements that we've got today, and looking to apply that to the server side, whereas today it's just on at D7, it's just on the device side.
So I put a recommendation in column J to explicitly define the data that is in scope for the definition of EHI or refer to the relevant section of the preamble. Would that address the concern, Cheryl?
I can actually find that, so I don't need them to do it. I'll look for it now that I understand what they're saying. That's fine.
No, but I mean, I guess even if by the nature of having this call required you to understand, that was helpful. Do you think there's anything we should recommend in terms of helping clarify that for others?
Let me look it up and then I'll get back to you on that, Mark.
Okay.
I just want to see how that reference is made, and I'm going to go back to the rule, but I'll bring that up in the comments if I think we need to clarify it more. And I think Hans has had his hand up for a bit.
Hans?
Yes, I want to just provide a general context here as well, that to date, server side, where the data is stored, data at rest, a variety of terms being used there that have not been there, in part because there has been part of certification, a requirement for risk assessment, otherwise, and depending on your data center, where is it stored, how is it done, et cetera, that encryption may or may not be considered necessary for the risk profile at hand. So there was flexibility there to do it or not. So part of the follow-up, and that's why I don't have comments immediately, is to say is that in today's world, this has been for a while, today's world where we're at, is that still a reasonable approach, because encryption also at least relatively always comes at a cost as well, and from a performance perspective. So that's where why I need to follow up a little bit more, is that we have been working under that risk assessment approach and risk management approach, where based on that, you may or may not decide to encrypt for data at rest. Is that still reasonably applicable? And therefore, there's a question why this is needed, or is it reasonable right now to adjust based on all the other factors that have changed over the last couple of years? So that's the context of why you don't hear me yet. But I want to give that backdrop.
Perfect. So I just put that in the discussion column I, and then we can come back to this. Okay, so we have one row left and want to confirm with Sarah. I think we have 6 minutes for this row, and this is our last row. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So let's take 30 seconds. We'll start the timer and then we'll open it up. Okay, so this row is about encrypting the authentication credentials. So at least from my read of this, Hans, this is going to be lower burden compared to encrypting all data server side. And I'm anticipating that this one will probably also want to come back to once we have more information from folks. But any initial thoughts, recommendations from members of the task force?
I think the only question I have here is, by removing the expiration as or no, if you replace with this new standards, how big is the burden for the folks to transition to this protect stored authentication credentials model and this new federal standard? Is it a big of an effort, or it is as good as what we have done before?
Do you have a sense of that, Hans?
Well, before it was an attestation, which really meant you do it or you don't, and then you have... if you do it, you can do it a particular whatever way. So mm-hmm. I think the question is much more about the standard. is that the appropriate standard? That's the part that I need to get a little bit more consensus feedback to provide a perspective from the EHR community.
Okay. And Hans, just to make sure I understood, so you're saying it's more of a question of, is this the right standard to reference for encryption?
That will be the only question, which I don't think is going to, given the context, I don't expect that. But that's, I think, for that we have not really asked everybody yet to say, okay, are we good with that or not from that regard? Oh. So I just want to get that confirmation that before I say here, yeah, we are okay, or no, we should suggest another one. I just want to get that confirmation.
Sounds good. So I'll put a TBD in. Any other comments from members? If not, then I think that's our last row. We have, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Mark. I was going to say that if y'all'd like to keep discussing one of the other rows or topics, we have time, the public comments at 3:20.
Exactly. Yeah, I was just going to ask. If we want to scroll up, I know that we had a lot around the first two. So maybe let's scroll over to column J just to make sure that everyone is good with what we're recommending for those first two. Or if anyone has any thoughts, things they'd want to change, feel free to raise your hand or just go off mute. Okay, so if these look good, then I think we're done with this part. And I think that'll take us to the public comment. Can we start that early, Seth?
Yes, we can start the public comment now. And then one other suggestion, since we do have a few extra minutes, is we are at a point kind of in the group process where we want to be transitioning from, you know, the individual comments to, as we started here, into the draft recommendations from the group. So if there's any that we want to circle back to, just to identify potential members of the group that will want to take a first cut at the group recommendations based on the individual comments, we could use some of the time for that as well. But let me pivot into public comment. Estelle, could you please open up our line for public comment? So if you are on the Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located in the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you are participating by phone only today, you can press *9 to raise your hand. And then once called upon, you can press *6 to mute and unmute your line. And as we give folks a few seconds to raise their hands, I wanna just remind everybody that the next group two meeting is gonna be on October 22nd from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. And as a reminder, the materials from today's meeting and all high-tech meetings can be found on healthit.gov. I'm not seeing any hands raised online. Estelle, do we have any folks calling in?
No public comments.
All right, thank you. Back to you, Mark. So again, we can close out and end a little early, or if there are additional things that the group wants to circle back on, we have a few minutes.
I mean, just following up on your comment, Cheryl, I'll come back to you in a sec, but Hans, especially since it sounds like you're trying to get information from folks, do you think maybe by the next meeting you can put content in for rows that'll be 35, 36, 37 that we can try to follow up on.
Sounds good.
Cool. So I'll just make a comment there. And then Cheryl, I saw your hand was raised.
Yeah, I had a couple comments. I guess you must have discussed it last week, but I wasn't here. One was on row 24, and I'm trying to see where the other one was. Will we have time next time to talk about those?
So yes, there were a handful that were related to payer. I am considering we have some time. I'm okay. If we want to spend a few minutes now, are other folks okay doing?
It was 7 and 24 are the two that where I had written something. And I'm sorry, I was away last week and I couldn't join. I was in another call I had to take.
Sarah, were you going to say something? Is it better to do that next week?
Oh, no, this week is fine. There's time. Let me just give me 1 second and I'll bring the spreadsheet back up.
Yeah, I don't think we'll have time to do both of them, but if we can do one, that would be great.
Yeah. So do you want to do 7? The first one? Dynamic client registration protocol.
Yeah. So this is the one where I was recommending that we, especially this is important for certified health IT vendors and providers who buy what I'm going to call out of the box solutions. Often those out of the box solutions supposedly are easy to connect. And I will tell you by experience, they are not. So what we're hoping we can recommend is that those certified health IT vendors, and really any certified health IT vendor, could offer some sort of, as part of the certification, a default network that they can register the product with. And there are multiple, I believe both Care Quality and eHealth Exchange at a minimum, offer a proving ground where you can test the process and do the connection and then be able to offer that as an option. And I discussed at least with one of them that this is something that perhaps we can look at for a project, which I recommended to HL7. So we are going to try to do it as a project in the, not as TEFCA, but in the, I forget what they're calling it, but the other type of proving ground that HL7 is putting together. And we're going to be talking about that in the next week or two. But I really think this is something we need to consider for certification because it removes the burden from the provider. It actually puts it on the vendor where it really needs to be. And that way, if they want to elect to keep the network, they can. If they don't, they can turn it off. But at least then they know that the product actually can connect to a network and it works. Today, there's certification criteria and there's testing tools. But in the end, we have found that those do not equal success in connecting to a network without a lot of burden. And most of the providers who buy those off-the-shelf products don't have the IT people. They don't have the resources. And even with HIEs working with payers, we are unable to connect in many situations with those products. And I don't want to call products out by name, but it's more than one.
And so just to confirm, it seems like the particularly important part to carry over is that first sentence.
Yes.
Okay. Does anyone would anyone modify that sentence that I just dropped into column J?
Possibly. I'm not sure yet how, but I'm still trying to understand. And Cheryl, maybe you can provide a little bit more context of what the problem that it solves. Currently, certified software has to provide endpoints, directory lists for all their fire service for the client. And for some, that might go through a gateway, other ones go to individual endpoints, et cetera, but they have to provide that. Having that, which network are you looking at to really be, quote unquote, a default, which we know in typical situations is not going to be the one that's going to be used in production. So that's what I'm trying to understand, what this really meant with it, or am I not quite getting what you're trying
to? It really haunts any default network, because at the end of the day, the problem is that even though there are requirements that they provide endpoints, et cetera, a point-to-point connection can't even be made to those endpoints is the problem. So the success of those, and maybe it means there needs to be better auditing of the information that's out there for some of these certified health IT products. And it's typically not the top five, it's the rest of the list, which unfortunately represents about 20 to 30% or more of our smaller providers. So from a payer's perspective, we still want to be able to connect to these providers without burden on the provider or ourselves. And essentially today, either there's information missing where there needs to be some sort of integration in order to make that connection happen, but it's not documented out on the federal website where all of this information is presented, or some other problem. But we've actually worked on at least three of these other providers with not being able to connect successfully, not only ourselves, but working with HIEs.
That sounds like there might need to be a or statement in there, so that if you don't do X, which what some do and it works, then at a minimum you need to do Y, so that we know that regardless that it always works. Because the way I'm hearing it, but I want to digest a little bit further and share this conversation, is to that if you did it quote unquote right with everything, you don't need this. But the certification criteria as currently suggested to be updated would require it. So then we're providing double capability. That's what I'm trying to see, is that what is it that when you do it right, you would not have to do this.
Right, but the problem is, you know that there's limited capabilities to audit everything that's out there. So then leaving it to doing it right, then the burden also goes back to the provider, because the provider is the one that can't connect. It doesn't go back to the vendor, who is the one responsible for implementing a solution that can't be, it actually doesn't work. So that's where we need to do something different, Hans, here, because it needs to be more than, yes, I've certified this works. And again, with an attestation, it needs to be a demonstration. That's what we're saying.
Yeah, I guess I would like to see a little bit more specifics on what that would look like to understand how that would apply.
Right. And that's what we were hoping the Trebuchet, if I'm saying it right, that project would hopefully demonstrate.
Which means is that at this point in time, the guidance on what that would look like, it would still have to be developed. And by the time that we are getting to the final rule of this, that might not be in place yet. So I'm not sure what we can currently suggest beyond a suggestion to look at something or address a problem, rather than that we have a concrete. If we just say you need to have a default network, I'm not sure what that exactly means, if that were to pop up in certification with the rest of it.
Maybe we could come up with revised wording, but it needs to be something needs to be there, because leaving it as is still equals not success, which won't accomplish the underlying goal of the rule.
And no disagreement on the goal. I'm trying to figure out, is that how is this helping move it forward in a clear way that is not duplicating effort either?
So Hans, I made a note in I, if you could look over this and try to propose some adaptation, that would be helpful. Hung, I see your hand also.
Just listening to the conversation, maybe a alternative suggestion could be setting up some kind of registry where customers who are struggling with it can provide documentation that, you know, maybe the ASTP maintains this website so that for products that continually fail, they can be identified. And, you know, that could be a way to identify health IT that shouldn't be certified. Because if the audit, either we need to have improved auditing or we need improved reporting of issues, because if all it takes is saying I'm certified, my product works, and there's no way to verify that, or there's no recourse for clients who struggle with implementing it, then I do agree something needs to change. So either auditing needs to be strengthened, or there needs to be a reporting system.
And so it's a registry for reporting kind of connection failures?
Implementation failures,
because what's happening today is the burden's all on the provider. If the provider can't connect, the provider's the one that's going to be held to the information blocking rule, not the vendor that provided the software that they said was certified and then doesn't work. And the provider doesn't have IT people. They don't have resources to make that happen. So essentially, I'm saying something needs to be here to hold the vendor accountable for making it work and making sure that it does work. And I agree, maybe having additional information out on that a website that says, hey, these are the trouble. Well, this is the trouble that different organizations are having with the vendor connections. But to me, it needs to go beyond that and go beyond auditing. It needs to be where the certified vendor has to demonstrate interoperability. If the big vendors are already doing that because they're part of a network, then it would just be, you know, demonstrating a certification that is already in place. But these small vendors who are not demonstrating interoperability then would have to do something, where if you already demonstrated it, you wouldn't have to do that. But if you haven't demonstrated it, you would have to do it.
This is very similar to the issues that have been faced over the years with public health reporting, that particularly in the early days of meaningful use, some of the technology might have been certified that the EHR could send the data, but it was actually not populated very well. So the data that was actually sent to public health wasn't really usable.
So I want to thank everyone. This is an important discussion that we will need to continue. I've tried to capture some of the main highlights in column I, and we will try to come back to row 7 in a future discussion. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you.